Bill Alcoholic. My wife told me as I came up here, don't fall. I'd like to thank the committee for having us up here. This has really been a hoot. Is that better? Okay. Camp Dog Judy for keeping in touch with us on a regular basis. Lots of emails. John and Will, our 9-month sober driver. We are part of the now infamous ride from the airport on Friday. That was a special treat. We had no idea that it was going to test our patience. I'm a two-fisted drinker. We get up here a lot. You can tell that because I do know how to pronounce Puyallup. Thank you. I've been working on that. I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, which is something I don't necessarily recommend. When my father died in 1999, he was 45 years sober. You know, this weekend you've heard some great speakers. Father Tom is one of my favorite people. One of the real special things about getting to go around and speak a little bit is that you get to hang out with the speakers. And some of these people I've grown up in AA listening to. And Tom is one of those guys. You have no idea how much this man does. He had a lot to do with starting the retreat movement in Alcoholics Anonymous. Out of the Catholic Church. It was really phenomenal. I think is it Karen was our Al-Anon speaker? Kathy, yeah. I remember hearing her before, and the reason I started off talking about my parents is because of her story. If you missed the Al-Anon luncheon, that's too bad. Try to go to the Al-Anon luncheon. I mean, if nothing else, it makes you feel better about yourself. I mean, these Al-Anon people are troubled souls, and Kathy is certainly one of those. And, you know, the powerful part of her story is talking about watching her sons. I mean, after the tragedy of her marriage and stuff, then the kids start growing up, and then they start raising hell. That's what my parents did with me. They watched me. And it's a painful thing if any of you have ever, maybe are experiencing that now, watching your kids. Alcoholism runs in my family, and so does recovery. I think recovery might be genetic. You never know. You know, Tom is the story of a fallen priest, and, you know, Kathy's the story of a fallen housewife, and Patty is just fallen. You know, it's a tragic story. We continue to watch her recover. It's really been a treat to spending time with Patty. I've listened to her for years. And I grew up listening to my parents. I grew up, I was 6 years old. My dad got fired from a job. And rather than go to the bar, he came home, which was odd. I think it was probably my mother that called Alcoholics Anonymous, and he went to a meeting in Inglewood, California on Western Avenue. He came back from that meeting and he told my mother, he says, you know, those people have got something down there, and I'm going to go back and find out what it is. And the next night she went with him in order to monitor the experience. And they went walking in that room, and this woman saw my mother there, and she ran up to her and said, asked her why she was there. And she says, well, I'm here to make sure he fills out the forms and pays the dues and talks to the right people. And this woman took my mother into the other room. And like I say, when she died in 2002, she was 48 years in Al-Anon. You know, she helped... She helped found the intergroup of the Al-Anon Central Office in L.A. and did a lot of work. I would come home from school, and there would be people laying on the back porch waiting for their sponsor to come home. And one day I came home, and there was a woman hiding in the garage. That was the Al-Anon. Don't make Al-Anon jokes if you don't know what it is. If you know what it is, you can make some great Al-Anon jokes. Just think of the consciousness of an individual that would live with us on purpose. What are they thinking? Oh, this will be fun. You know, something to do on the weekends. I don't recommend growing up in an AA house. There's nothing worse than living in a house with two people with clear eyes that know exactly what's going on in your head. When it was my turn to drink, I did it with a vengeance. I was probably 14 or 15. Remember waiting around for it? I can remember, you know, you have a sip on a few beers every now and then, you know, and you kind of get a taste and... But then finally you get the job done. You know, you go out there and you get hammered. And this friend of mine's older brother was having a party. We went there and helped him do something. He let us drink whatever we wanted, and we choked down a couple of 16-ounce glasses of whatever we could pour in there, you know. And I caused some trouble at the party, and they drove me back to my house and dumped me out on the front lawn. I crawled into the house and crawled down the hallway and into my bedroom, and I'm laying on the bed with one foot on the floor to stop the spinning. And back in those days, we used to have these big plastic things called records, you know, and we played them on furniture called record players. And some of these pieces of furniture had lids on it, so I puked in the record player. I crawled down the hallway into the bathroom, and I'm sitting on the toilet because there's, you know, with a trash can between my legs because it's coming out both ends. And I remember the door opening up, and I look at up, and my mother's standing there with this aghast expression on her face, and my father's standing behind her laughing hysterically, you know. And both of them in their own way were saying, "Oh my God, it begins." And it started off. It just, I never crossed a line. I didn't know there was a line. I drank for effect immediately, and, it changed my life, you know. I mean, it did all the stuff that it does for all of us, you know. And you have no idea that it doesn't do that for other people, you know. I heard this new guy in a meeting one time not too long ago. People were talking about, you know, they may come up with a pill that will address alcoholism. You know, ultimately, they'll come up with something that will block that genetic response or something. And this one guy says, he says, "Man, if I could drink normally, I'd drink all the time." I don't know what pill they're going to use for that kind of thinking. You know, it's very special. You know, I heard another new guy. There's great, great quotes. I heard another new guy some months ago. He said, "The fog is beginning to lift, and the planes are starting to land." You know, and I thought, whoa. You know. I think it was the same guy that said, "I know it's an inside job, I just don't know how to get in there." You know. By the time I was 17 years old, I was a bad drunk in high school. I was irretrievable. You could not talk to me. I had the slouch. I had the uniform. I had the foul mouth. I remember walking into the boys' vice principal office because I hadn't been there for a while, and I came back, and he brought me in the office, and I'm slouched in a chair across from his desk, and he says, "Sit up." And I went, "No." And he looked at me for a couple of minutes, and he went, "Never mind." Now, when you leave the office, you feel like you got away with something. but you don't feel good about it. I mean, I was not worth talking to. You couldn't talk to me. If you had any kind of authority at all, you just pissed me off. I had a bit of a problem with authority. And you hear people in AA talk about that to this day. They talk about it like it's a badge of honor. I'm here to report to you that is a character defect. And when you're 14, 15, 16, it's kind of cute. When you're 40, it's just stupid. You know? And I had it bad. I had it bad. It says in the doctor's opinion, it says the alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. That even though that we know that it is injurious, that after a while we cannot differentiate the true from the false. How do we create a reality around us that makes it okay to behave the way we behave, to puke on our friends and hit on the neighbor's wife and stuff? How do we do that? Well, rule number one, it has to be someone else's fault. I can never take responsibility for my own behavior, because if I do, I can no longer behave that way because it's not unjustifiable. I can't do that. So it has to be someone else's fault. And I created a persona around me that made it okay for me to behave the way I behave. And my persona was I was the rebel. It was the 60s. I'm a child of the 60s. I graduated from high school in 1965. You'll hear people say, I wouldn't trade my worst day sober for my best day drunk. I wouldn't trade 66 and 67 for anything. I mean, from what I remember of it, it was a hoot. You know, Patty and I were there, and I remember her. And, it was a hoot, man. You know, I mean, the road from L.A. to San Francisco was the road to Nirvana. Golden Gate Park was the center of the universe. It was summertime all the time. They weren't eating hitchhikers yet, so it was safe to travel, you know. And the young ladies were discovering their sexuality, and we were helping them as best we could, you know. It was just a great time, you know. And I can't tell stories about it anymore because I'm really not sure really what happened. I'm pretty sure I did not live with Joan Baez. But I said I did for years. I'm not really a liar. I'm just a little deluded. I was a surfer and a biker and a tough guy. And I never went to the beach. My motorcycle rarely ran. And I was afraid to fight. But I looked really good. I had a chrome Nazi helmet for a hat and a primary chain for a belt and black greasy Levi's and big black boots with chains around them. I've got tattoos all over me. But I had a clip-on earring because I didn't want to hurt myself, you know. So I see there's some other phonies in the room. You know, my people. And that's pretty much my story, you know. You know, Patty actually made it through college. She doesn't remember it. I couldn't even find the goddamn place. You know, I don't know. There's difference, you know. And by the time I was 22 years old, I was in the Oregon State Mental Institution. I needed a rest. And remember the party? Remember? Wasn't that the whole idea? Was to have a party? Wasn't that the idea? Was to have a couple of drinks and get out of the house. Meet her, get lucky, have some adventures, you know, have a party. I don't know about you, but I ended up naked in my living room watching religious television, taking notes. I'm having sex, menage a uno. Party. You know. And we're getting down with Billy now. You know, so. What the hell happened to the party? Huh? I mean, the party didn't last very long for me. I mean, I started drinking when I was 14, 15, and I was in trouble. I'd already been to jail by the time I was 17, and by the time I'm 22, I'm in the mental institution. Anybody else here been in a mental institution? Oh, that's not enough hands. There's a bunch of you out there thinking to yourself, well, it really wasn't an institution. They were just observing me, you know. If they lock the door behind you, it's a goddamn institution, you know. Only those of us that have been in a mental institution know that it's not that bad. You have some sparkling conversations in the mental institution. It's an eclectic crowd. It's a great place to look for a bride. I'd like to introduce you to my wife, Karen. She would like me to say for the tape that I did not find her in the mental institution. I so often think about that girl. I fell in love in the mental institution. I had gotten married. I met this girl in Bass Lake, California, and we went up to Oregon to grow our own, and we had two children, and those kids now are almost 40 years old, and both of them are pretty much on the street, especially the older one, and he's a pretty bad junkie, and the younger one just can't stop drinking. I'm just glad that they're not down in L.A., so when I'm driving down the street, I see them pushing their shopping cart, you know. It's painful to watch. I have been in meetings with those kids where I've had my father, myself, and both of them all in the same AA meeting to get three generations of Cleveland alcoholics. And every time I sat in a meeting with them, I thought, oh, they're going to get it now. They'll get it now. They'll run with the ball. And so far, not yet. And it's getting worse. It gets worse and it gets worse. Neither one of them have a driver's license. One of them has never, ever had one. And 40 years old. Absolutely incapable of taking care of themselves. Their untreated Al-Anon mother has finally let go of them to some degree. At least they don't live with her anymore. They live in an old camper truck out in front of this guy's house. And it's just sad. It's just that I won't send them money anymore. I can't send them any money anymore. Just sad. But I got married and I had two children and I lost a house and I lost a car and a couple cars and I lost several jobs and I lost that family essentially to divorce. And I ended up in a mental institution at 22 years old. 22. I needed you at 22. At 22. I was done at 22, and I had 15 more years to go. They tell us that we won't regret the past. Well, kind of. It's kind of true. Every time I think about that, I think, God, I could have got sober at 22. One of my prejudices when I came into AA and I'd been sober a while is, what are these goddamn young people doing here? Now, do you suppose that I was a little jealous? You know? Then you know how you find out what they're doing here? One of them walks up and asks you for help, and you listen to the story, and you go, oh, I remember. I remember that. I remember being 19 years old and feeling lost. I remember being 19 years old and knowing that it wasn't working. At 19, I knew it wasn't working. I don't know that I could have expressed that to you, but I remember being in that space. And at 22, when you're in the mental institution, when you wake up in the morning and you're in the institution, that's a pretty good indication that maybe the party has stopped. You know. I went back to that institution a second time, and I came back down to California. And I hated my parents. I didn't like much anybody, really, but I hated my parents. And I really, really, really intently disliked my father. I hated him passionately. I really didn't like the guy, and he didn't like me much either. And when I came back down to California, you can hate your parents, but you can overlook things when you need something, you know. And he gave me a job in his machine shop in El Segundo, and he let me sleep in his garage. And I tried to put my life back together. When I was up in Oregon and I ended up in the mental institution, I'm sticking needles in my arm every day. I'm running with an outlaw motorcycle gang. I was strung out. I was drunk. I was violent. I was in a lot of trouble. And I was addicted to all kinds of things, you know. And when I came to California, I tried to clean myself up. And you got to do a couple of things when you're trying to clean up. Number one, you can't find anybody to go along with the concept of social heroin use. It's pretty much a lifestyle, you know. So I had to quit doing that. You have to quit taking acid because you got to talk to people, you know. And when you're seeing things, it's difficult to track the conversation. So you have to quit doing that. And so what you do is you drink on the weekends because normal people drink on the weekends. You cannot drink during the week. The reason you cannot drink during the week is because normal people have jobs. And when I drink, I don't show up no matter what. Everything stops. I mean, literally, everything stops. I don't go to work. I don't do anything. I just drink. I party. We call it partying. So what you do during the week is you smoke pot because it's green and it's from God and it's not really drugs, you know. It's what you do in between getting really high. And it's just maintenance. Because there has to be some cushion between you and I. The impact of your personality on me is devastating. I cannot do you straight up with naked blood. I need something to cushion the impact of you on me. There has to be something in my system. Always. Or I can't deal with you. I can't communicate with you. I can't interact at all. So I tried this experiment for 15 years, and as you can imagine, it failed miserably. And at 37 years old, I was really done so far. I was done. And my mother sent me to my first shrink when I was 13 years old because I didn't have anger. Anger is an appropriate emotional response to a negative situation. What I had was rage. I had double over, fall on the floor, bile in the throat, eyes bulging, veins throbbing in your neck, fist in the wall, head into the wall, rage. I was just pissed off at the injustice of it all. I can remember one time running out of my parents' house. I have no idea how old I was. I ran out of the house and just threw myself down on the ground, just in some kind of apoplectic seizure from just rage, just pissed off. My mother looked at this and said, "There's something wrong with the boy." And she took me to a therapist. And I spent a year and a half with that guy at 13, and he helped me. I got some help, and he introduced me to my favorite subject, me. That never-ending search for self. Never-ending. But I find myself utterly fascinating. You know, I can do me forever. You know, forever. You ever notice how there's never any end to it? You know, I mean, you just dig down the ground, you pick up a stone, and there's pill bugs underneath it, and underneath that there's another rock, and you peel that one, and it just seems to never end, you know. I have no trouble telling you secrets about myself. Matter of fact, if the conversation lulls, I'll just make some shit up. You know, I just do it. I do. You'd love to have me in your group. I'm really interactive, you know. It's fun. So at 13, she took me to my first one. I've been in the mental institution several times. I spent 2.5 years in group therapy at one time. I've been to several other psychiatrists for one thing or another. I've been observed. I've been gestalted and rolfed and primal screamed. I know more about myself than is safe to know. But it is my favorite subject. So at 37, when the jig was up, and I needed a rest, I could not imagine just coming to AA and not drinking. Could you? I mean, every single one of us, every one of us, at some point in time, looks in the mirror, some morning and you look in the mirror and you look at that guy in the eyes and you say, I got to cut this shit out. Every one of us says that. We have some kind of a moment of clarity, maybe for a long period of time, but you can't really imagine not drinking. I mean, you know that it's killing you. You make some kind of connection. You know in your heart of hearts when nobody else is around that this has to stop, this has to change, but you can't really imagine not doing it. How am I going to live without it? And that's where I was at 37. I knew that it was killing me. I could feel death coming up behind me. I was extremely ill. I've got liver disease. I'm still struggling with it. And back then it was just inflamed and I was sick. I was sick. I had no strength. I couldn't get around. I couldn't breathe. I'm smoking 40 packs a day. I was in bad shape, but I couldn't imagine. So I knew I had to check myself in somewhere. I needed a rest. I needed to get away. That's my MO. So I called my mother. I called the Al-Anon. Now, my parents never preached to me. They never brought me in and sat me down and had the big talk. They just watched. And after I got sober, I found out what was going on behind the scenes. But they never tried to intervene on me. They never, none of that. And my mother came and she picked me up silently. She picked me up before I changed my mind. She was real active in the recovery industry around L.A. She knew all the players. She knew where to take me. And she drove me to this place in Costa Mesa called Starting Point and checked me in there for a 35-day program. While I was in there, they made me wear a sign around my neck. I had to make the sign. We made it in crafts. It was a little rectangular piece of cardboard with a string that went through it, and I wore it around my neck, and it said, I am not a counselor. Because evidently there was some confusion about that. I wish I'd have kept the sign. So I spent 35 days in there. It was a pretty straight-ahead place. They work you up through a fifth step. And, they did a bunch of therapy and, things like that. But what it did for me is it separated me from alcohol for 35 days. Now, in the end of my drinking, there was no more hip dope. There was no more heroin. There was no more speed. None of that stuff, It was me and a gin bottle. I couldn't smoke pot anymore. It made me paranoid, And I was just sucking on a gin bottle. There wasn't much left. There was no more hip. There's a controversy in Alcoholics Anonymous about alcoholics and addicts and are they the same and how you should identify yourself. And every once in a while it rears its ugly head. Everybody knows, anybody that's been out there in the street knows that there's a difference between alcoholics and drug addicts. I have to remember that the way I ended up in the mental institution the first time is I called the police on myself. Now, here's an operational definition between an alcoholic and a drug addict. No self-respecting drug addict would ever call the police on himself. But an alcoholic will do it and think it's a pretty good idea. There is a level of lameness in the alcoholic that simply does not exist in the hip, contemporary rock and roll drug addict of today. All those in favor? I'll let New York know. So then after 35 days, they let me out. They let us out. They just let us out. See ya. Now what? I'm telling you, man. After all the insurance money runs out, when they're all done gestalting and rolfing and primal screaming, they send us to the world's aftercare program, AA. This is it. There are no referrals from Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no place you go where you walk in and you go, I'm from AA, they sent me here. That place does not exist. This is the end of the road. It's metal folding chairs, linoleum floors for the rest of our natural lives. Party! Jeez. AA. My friend Scott Redmond says, Alcoholics Anonymous has offered me a level of lameness that I did not know was available. I walked into my first meeting in the Hermosa Beach Alano Club. It was called the Gong Show on a Friday night. And there you all were. You all looked like you were about 12. And you're running up to the podium and you're saying, I'd like to thank God and my sponsor for my sobriety. And then the coup de grace, this is California's, happy birthday to you. And I remember standing in the back of that room looking at my shoes thinking, I can't do this. This is too stupid. You know? I remember driving home that night thinking to myself, what am I going to do? Because I can't go there. Somebody might see me. You got to picture this. Stop and think about this, because this is a common disease. It's kind of ancillary to alcoholism, but it's a common disease. It's called the I'm too hip for AA syndrome. Now, you have to picture this. I am fat, bald, and 40, and I think I'm too hip for AA. This is not denial. To be in denial, you actually have to know some shit. This is delusional. I haven't reached denial yet. Denial's a step up. And it's a real problem. You know, many of us come in. A lot of people don't stay. They sit in the back of the room and they're just too cool. I mean, like, there's no one left in their life, but they're too cool for AA. How many of you had the experience of going on a 12-step call? And you walk into the guy's place, you know, into his hovel, and you're sitting there and you're trying to help him, and he starts arguing with you about your approach to him. I mean, the arrogance of alcoholism is stunning. I mean, this is Saturday night, and the best this guy can come up with is to call AA, and now he's complaining about your approach to him. One of the rules in the 12-step handbook is never to talk down to an alcoholic. I have broken that rule many times. Those assholes need to be yelled at. You know, I've come close to beating a couple of them up. You know, and I've never actually laid hands on them. I've shoved one of them around a little bit though. And that was me. I'm in the back of the room critiquing you. And you're the one that's smiling. You're the one that's happy. And I cannot hear the music. I don't hear the music. I'm stuck there. And there's nothing you can do to make it more comfortable for me. Nothing. I have to be out of options. I mean, you can kind of be attentive. You could not recognize me and walk up to me and introduce yourself. That's nice. That helps. You know? But if I'm looking for a way out, I'm going to find it. If I'm not ready, I'm going to find my way out. So finally, after a couple of weeks, I asked a guy for some help. And he said, be at my house Thursday at 5 o'clock and read the doctor's opinion and make notes in the margin of what you agree with and what you don't, and we'll discuss it. He didn't ask me my last name. He didn't give me the pre-interview that I was expecting so that he could kind of get a feel for my case, so that he could approach me in such a fashion to make this transition into sobriety a little smoother for me. He didn't. Be at my house Thursday at 5. So I did my assignment and I made my notes in the margin. I mean, I was beaten, but I still had opinions. And I showed up at his house. Now, he did not trust me that I had read it, so he had me sit there and read it to him out loud. Rule number one when working with alcoholics, make sure they read the book. Do not, repeat, do not leave it up to them to read the book. If you're the kind of sponsor that says, yeah, read the book. If you run into some trouble, give me a call. Change your way. Sit with them. Make sure they read it. Make sure you read it. You know? You want to do another inventory? Sponsor people. You'll always be in the inventory process, you know? And that's what this guy did. He sat there and he had me, we took turns reading pages, and he brought certain things that he considered salient up to me. And one of those things is that it describes four or five different kinds of alcoholics in there, and he stopped me and he asked me which one I was. And we discussed a little bit, and I said, well, I think I'm this one here. He says, well, circle it, put a star next to it. You're in the book. And he explained to me, he says, this book is written to you, not at you. It's written to you. It's about you. And you should be able to find yourself in it. If you can't, then you can't identify. There's a problem. But you just have told me that you found yourself in the book. So you're on the path. You're on the way. Here we go. Hold on. He explained to me that his job as my sponsor is to help bring about a psychic change so that I will be comfortable in my sobriety, and maybe I'll stay that way. He said he'd be more than happy to talk to me about what I think my problems are so that I will not share about them in the meetings. He said the meetings are for recovery from alcoholism, not about how my day went. And I didn't know any different. You know, I just listened to him. He described to me his AA. He was not afraid to express his opinions to me. And I'm forever grateful to that. You ever heard people in AA say, the longer I'm sober, the less I know? Don't you wonder about those people? Aren't they paying attention? I mean, you can go to do meetings and do nothing else and pick some shit up, you know? I mean, the longer I'm sober, the less I know is false humility couched in spiritual pride. And what that is if you say that often enough, maybe that you'll finally get humble. And I don't think it works like that. You know? Bill Wilson says a very powerful thing after the ninth step. He says, our next function is to increase in understanding and effectiveness. I do not think that is the longer I'm sober, the less I know. I think what he's telling us is that you've done some stuff now. You know some stuff. Go get them. Go save the brothers and sisters. You have a message that has depth and weight now. Go use it. You'll hear people say, you got to give it away to keep it. No, you got to give it away to get it. If you really want it, you got to give it away. 1 through 9 is about 20% of the program. About 20%, if even that. It's sober 101. You got to do that to come up with some kind of a message. You've got to do it to just have something to share with somebody else. It's the beginning. It is not the end. When I make amends, I begin to stand a little taller. I feel better about myself. I've cleared the decks. I'm not looking over my shoulder anymore. Now there's hope that maybe I'll get it. But that is not it. It's just the beginning. 80% of the program is working with others. 80%. That is the program. Should everybody sponsor people? Absolutely. There is no other job in AA. There is no other job. There's a lot of other activity, which is good, and it makes us feel like part of the community. Never confuse the activity with the action. Don't fool yourself into believing that because you do a lot of different activity that you don't have to sponsor people, that you do other 12-step work. There is no other 12-step work. So every week I went to this guy's house and we read another chapter in the book and we worked the steps. When I did the 5th step, he looked at me and he says, you're a member now. You're in. And I said, I thought the only requirement for memory, he goes, yeah. We just tell that to people to lull them into a feeling of, so we can hook them. He says, you really want to be a member around here, you got to do some stuff. And you've done some stuff now. You're in. He went around and told other people, he says, you can talk to him now. He's okay. You know? And I thought that was kind of cool. He told me when I had 6 months sober, he says, you got to go down to the central office and sign up on the 12-step list. You cannot be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous if you're not on the 12-step list. I thought that's where they handed out the ID cards, so I rushed right down there. You know? And if I get on my knees and I ask God for help, I shouldn't send him away when he shows up. And when he shows up, he's going to look a lot like you. He's not going to look like Jesus or Buddha or Lao Tzu. He's going to look a lot like you. And he's going to ask me to do things. And there are going to be a lot of those things I'm not going to want to do because they're inconvenient or I'm unfamiliar with it or I'm afraid. So my tendency is going to be to say no. My tendency is going to be to pick and choose what I will and won't do like I've always done all my life. And I can find a lot of people in Alcoholics Anonymous that will support me in that effort to decide what I will and won't do. I believe that there's some lies around here. They're untruth. One of them is there's a different program for everyone in Alcoholics Anonymous. Make it your own. That was made up by an alcoholic that doesn't want to work the program. There's only one program in AA. It's very clear as to what it is. The thing that keeps us in these rooms together is not our past. It's that we have a way out upon which we all agree. We all agree on the way out. We all know what it is. We may not do it, but we all agree on what it is. It's the 12 steps. That is our pathway. And there is only one program, and that is the one. Now, you can choose not to do it if you want to, but let's agree that we all agree on what the program is. Along with that is, and this is a deadly one, take what you can use and leave the rest. Isn't that the way that you and I lived our lives, all of our lives? Isn't that how we lived? We took what was easy, what was cute, what was convenient, what belonged to somebody else. And anything that was difficult or made us uncomfortable or we didn't like or wasn't pretty, we just left it. And look where we ended up. Am I going to continue that behavior now in sobriety? Am I going to use this keen intellect of mine to determine what is healthy for me and what is not? Absolutely, the most spiritual thing said in Alcoholics Anonymous is get in the car. Get in the car. Well, where are we going? Just get in the car. Well, who else is going? What do you care? Get in the car. You know, what's on your social program that stops you from getting in the car? Just get in the car. Do everything. My sponsor told me that I don't get to pick and choose what I will and won't do. Those days are over. Put yourself at the top of the amends list. You've been your own worst enemy. That'll pretty much kill you. I love what Patty said last night about, I love myself. Maybe I lived self-destructively, but it wasn't conscious on my part. I'm taking care of me. I've always taken care of Billy. I want to feel good all the time. I never, ever want to feel bad. When I feel bad, there's something wrong that needs to be repaired immediately. It's time now for me to let something else run my life. If in the first step, if I can really grasp and understand at depth the concept of powerlessness and unmanageability, that is good news. It is not bad news. I've been a very poor manager of my life. now something else is going to enter my life that's going to manage my life for me. This is good news. It takes that burden of management off of me. It makes the second step operative. It allows me to work the second step if I can cop to the unmanageability and the powerlessness. The second step then becomes a reality in my life that something is going to enter into my life that is going to take over the management responsibility, restore me to sanity, and help me to live some kind of a healthy life. It makes perfectly good sense then in the third step to make the decision to turn my life and my will over to it. If it's going to do management, well then we need to give it the stuff that it needs to manage. Take this. What is it? What is my life and will? It's the fourth step. It's the resentments, the fears, and the broken relationships. Here, take them. The fifth step is the physical and literal turning it over. You can't do a third step without the fourth and the fifth step. If you don't do a third, fourth, and fifth, then you clearly haven't done the second, and you have not copped to powerlessness and unmanageability. They're linked inexorably. You cannot do one without the other. The sixth and seventh step are about character defects. Have I done my fifth step? Am I empowered now and I'm going to be able to pick off sloth and jealousy and envy? I don't think so. I don't think it works like that. I think you are going to enter into my life and you're going to show me my character defects in stark living color. I will see myself through your eyes much better than I will ever flesh it out on my own. I cannot recover without you. You are an integral part of my recovery. If I am not sitting alone in a room with you, reading the book with you, I'm not going to recover. You ever had anybody say to you, he's not emotionally available for me? You ever heard that? Usually it's in family group. You know what they mean by that? What they mean by that is that I've got something that they want and I'm withholding it. The truth is worse. I don't have it. It's not there. You've convinced me, however, that I have it and I'm withholding it. You've convinced me of that. Because what's worse is I don't know that I don't have it, but you've convinced me that I'm withholding it. And I'm helping you look for it. And this dance is going to go on for a long, long time. Now, if you want me to be emotionally available for you, and I get sober, if you want me to be there for you, it's going to take about 10 years. 10 years. And I'll promise you something. If all I'm doing is just going to meetings, it will never happen. Ever. It won't even get a little bit better. Matter of fact, it could get worse. I'm sober now and all I'm doing is going to meetings. And maybe I'm doing that endless boring cycle of inventory after inventory after inventory after inventory after inventory. And I'm going through that horrible cycle of changing one sponsor after another, waiting for somebody to enlighten me. And it's never going to happen. If on the other hand, I start working with other people, if I start reading the book with other people, if I sit alone with them and I invite them into my life and I allow them to invite me into their life and I actually show up, I'll start growing emotionally. Because isn't it true that when you and I started drinking and using, we stopped growing emotionally? Isn't that what happened? I think that's what happened. And I think the journey in recovery is now I'm going to grow up. I'm going to do it now. And the chances of me doing it now and looking good are really slim. It's going to be hard for me to grow up at 40 years old when I should have done it when I was 15 or 16. Now I'm sober now and I'm 37, 38 years old and on a good day, I've got the emotional development of a 16-year-old and this kid is not an honor student. He's the one with a bit of a problem with authority. You ever heard the term alcoholic thinking? You only hear that in AA. The rest of the world calls it emotional immaturity. We hear that term and we go, no, it's more special than that. I have special thinking. I have alcoholic thinking. It's very unique and special. It's different than emotional immaturity. It's more complex than that. I think it's just emotional immaturity. This sponsor of mine took me through the process of the steps. He helped me do my inventory. He helped me make my amends. He took me on 12-step calls with me. He introduced me to his friends. He said the reason I was sent to AA is that you needed better transportation. And I had a car, so I drove the assault vehicle for years. I still kind of do. So time went on. I started sponsoring people when I was probably 1 year sober, maybe even a little less. And I've done it now for 21 years. And I'll tell you something. It has changed my life. I was in my kitchen one day, and this guy was in the kitchen with me, and he had just left the hospital, and his mother was dying. He'd been nursing her for about 2 or 3 years. I watched this man do this, not always very gracefully, but he took care of his mother. He popped her hip back into place and changed her diapers and did all of that. And she was finally close to death, and he had taken her to the hospital, and she was dying. And he had given the hospital my phone number because he knew that's where he'd be when he left the hospital. And sure enough, they called. And he's standing there in the kitchen, and they told him, you better get over here. She's close. And he wasn't leaving. He was looking at me, and I knew what he wanted, and I didn't want to go. I was afraid. I'd never seen anybody dying like that in ICU or anything. You know, I'd never seen that before, and I didn't want to go. It wasn't my family. I hardly knew the woman. He had a family, had a brother and a sister and other people that could have gone with him. But for some reason, they trust us. Isn't that odd? For some reason, for some inexplicable reason, they feel closer to us than they do their own families. I feel closer to you than I do my own family, in a very real way, given my family. I feel much closer to you. And this guy wanted me to go with him. So finally I said to him, and he couldn't ask me. He couldn't say the words. And I said, Al, do you want me to go with you? And he goes, would you please? So I went to the hospital with him. And we walked in the room, and it was awful. She's all hooked up to tubes and things, you know, and he's pacing the floor, and a feeling came over me that I can't really explain or really describe very well. It was a feeling that everything was okay, that there's nothing wrong here. This is the way it's supposed to be. And I sat down in this chair in the corner of the room, and I had him come and sit down next to me. He's a great big guy. He's as big as me, and he's a carpenter. He's got great big hands. And I held his hand, and I looked him in the eye, and I told him, you know, Al, everything's okay. There's nothing wrong here. This is all right. And we closed our eyes, and we said a prayer. And he had a hold of my hand really tight. And as we said this prayer, I could feel his grip relax in my hand. That's intimacy. And I miss it all the time. All the time I miss it. I'm always looking for a head rush. That's what I know. Emotions, I've come to understand, are very subtle, and they're quiet and peaceful things. And what you and I know is we know rage, we know screaming, and we know chaos because that we feel alive when that's happening. Maybe we were raised in that kind of an environment. We don't know about peace and serenity and intimacy, about holding someone's gaze and being quiet and allowing there to be quiet in a room between two people. There doesn't always have to be dialogue and words. And what happened to me that day changed my life. I felt that, and I was conscious of it. I was conscious of it happening. There's a difference between self-obsession and self-awareness. I think what happens to you and I here is that we become awakened. And then when we are awakened, there is a possibility of becoming aware of that awakening. That's the spiritual path that we're on, is developing that awakening, doing something with it. You bring that to me. You are an integral part of my life. You are part of who I am. You aren't just people that I associate with. You make up part of my personality. Without you, I am not whole. And I don't understand that. You frighten me. To enter into your world is frightening. It's vulnerable. There's risk and recklessness and all of that. And I have a tendency to shy away from it. So I paint myself into a corner. I never ever say no. Ever. And I always answer the phone. I don't have caller ID because it's always God calling. It's the modern age and it's how he gets a hold of us. I don't screen my calls because I'm not hiding from anything anymore. So after this experience with Al in the hospital room, other things began to happen. A friend of mine had a 7-year-old son who got leukemia, and it took the boy 2 years to die. And in the end, myself and my sponsor went to the hospital almost every day and sat with this guy. We stood around the little boy's bed, and we held hands, and we prayed for his death because he was in such horrible pain. My children, my 2 younger children, when I got sober, were very young, were about the same age, and it's the most frightening thing you could imagine, the death of a child. You were not supposed to outlive our children. And this man was losing his little boy slowly, inches by inches, every day. And the boy finally died. It did not have a happy ending. And we sat with this man and went through the experience of it with him. A friend of mine that I got sober with contracted lung cancer. And it took him about 3 years to die. And we used to take him to retreats with us, and he had an open wound in the back of his back that they left open in order to drain his lungs. And the doctor showed us how to pack the wound so that we could take him with us on weekend retreats and stuff. He said one of the most powerful things I've ever heard in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. He yelled at us in our men's stag, which is the only way to get our attention. He said, "If you're not grateful, you ought to be ashamed of yourself." And I really felt that. I mean, he felt that. He's sitting over there and he's dying, you know. I mean, and I went through the death of my friend Patrick. Karen and I both did. You know, his mother called him the devil of all liars. He was a little Irish. We used to sit in the hospital room and I said, "You know, Patrick, when you die, they're going to make a saint out of you. And people aren't going to know what a horrible weasel you really are." You know, he used to kiss my wife on the mouth right in front of me just because it would upset me. You know, but I love this man. I loved him like we love each other. You know, I mean, it's that real, real visceral kind of love. You know, I mean, I was passionate about how I felt about him. I still am. I still, you know, I bring him up, and he's still alive to me. And he died. I watched him die. I was with him when he died. So in 1999, my dad, the man I hated, remember the man I hated? How passionately I hated him? We could never share anything, but we shared AA together. He started showing up at my men's stag, which really pissed me off. You know? Here's this man that I really didn't like this guy at all. And I got to see the AA side of this man. I got to see him standing around with a bunch of guys telling dirty jokes. I'd never seen that before. I'd never seen him like that before. I'd never seen him around a bunch of guys. I never saw him in AA, really, not really. My birth date is March the 27th. His is March the 28th. We gave each other birthday cakes for 14 years in that meeting. I found my daddy. He found his son. We fell in love. We got to where we could stand each other's company for almost 2 hours. Remarkable. Remarkable. You know. I was able to, like Patty shared, I was able several times to share the podium with him where I would be his 10-minute speaker and he'd be the main speaker, you know. It's going to take me a long time to catch up to that 45 years, you know. But what a wonderful treat that was to be able to share AA. And I fell in love with my father. I fell in love with him again. He found his son. I mean, he was the kind of guy when I was growing up, he never hugged me. He wasn't a real huggy kind of guy. In the end, he could not keep his hands off of me. He was so proud of me. He saw me grow up. I think the greatest gift we give our parents in sobriety, the greatest gift we give them, is they look at us and they can say, he's okay. He made it. I don't have to worry about the boy anymore. Well, he got cancer. He's old. He got cancer. And he decided not to do the chemotherapy. And it took him about 6-8 months to die. I told him, I'm sitting in the living room with him one time, and I said, you know, I want you to know something. I'll take care of Mom. And he says, don't yell at her. And I go, I won't yell at her. And he goes, well, you know how she is. And I said, I know exactly how she is. And I won't yell. I said, but I reserve the right to roll my eyes and sigh real deeply. He goes, okay, you can do that. You know, and we had those talks. We had those talks about what he wanted me to take care of and what to do and all that stuff. And my mother and I took care of him. We nursed him. And one day we're standing by the side of his bed, and it was time to change the diaper. And my mother looked at me and she said, well, here we go. And I got to see my parents as lovers. This woman had seen his ass many times, you know. And she helped me. She showed me how to do this. She loved my father. And I got to see that really for the first time as an adult, that these were not just Mom and Dad out to get me, but these two people that came together and loved each other. They were married for 62 years. My father passed away. We had a wonderful memorial. If you've never been to an AA memorial, don't miss it. It's a real show. It's a real party. They talk about the real person and who he really was. And they love him anyway. And they laugh about it. And it's just wonderful. It's a wonderful healing experience. Our family members that showed up were a little shocked, you know. Of course, they're always a little shocked, you know. But my mother and I had a wonderful time. My mother moved in with Karen and I, and then she got cancer. When my dad was still alive, I had my mother to take care of, and he died, and I had her to take care of. And now my mother was dying, and she was in the living room of my house, and we put her in a hospital bed. She decided not to take the chemotherapy, and we went for the ride. This is Al-Anon. We went to the doctor. When the doctor gave her the news that she was terminal, she was 85 years old, she's terminal, and she turned and looked at me and asked me if I was okay. I wasn't. The Al-Anon started showing up to the house. This one woman took me in the back room. I spent 3 months with her. I just stayed home. I was in the position to be able to do that, and I stayed home with her and I nursed her. Al-Anon took me in the back room one time, and this woman asked me, she says, are you okay? And I went, well, I think so. And I just fell apart. And, you know, and they're always cooking. You ever notice Al-Anons? There was always lots of food, you know. And they showed up in force and took care of me. They took care of Priscilla's little boy. So one day I'm standing by the side of her bed and nobody else is in the room. And it was time to change the diaper. And I didn't know if I could do it, you know. I mean, I didn't know. And my mother was very upset. And I said, well, here we go. Let's go. And she started crying, and she looked at me, and she said, I never raised you to do this. And I looked at her, and I said, yes, you did. I remember that house I grew up in. I remember those people on the back porch. I know what you were doing. You were saving their lives. They were saving those people's lives. We had an old boy, Uncle Harold, we called him. He was like, became like a member of the family. And I watched that guy finally get sober, and he met a woman in AA. and he married her, and I went to the wedding, and then he got drunk, and then he got divorced, and I went to the funeral when he burned himself up alive in a hotel room smoking. And I knew at 13 years old the reason he died is because he drank. And my parents never gave up on him. They fed him, they got him clothes, they took him to meetings. I remember that house, and now I know what those people were doing. I have a house like that now. Karen and I live in a house like that now. The goddamn phone rings off the hook. It's always you. You never stop. And you don't really give a shit what's going on with us. You just want to talk about yourself. You show up at the door, you call me right in the middle of my favorite Law and Order rerun. So I changed my mother's diaper. And we crossed a barrier. We found a level of intimacy that we didn't know was there. The second time it was easier. The third time she says, "Bill, it's time." And there was no more barrier. That's love. Love is action, isn't it? Isn't that what love is? It's action. It's not an emotion in and of itself. It's what we do that shows people that we love them. You can tell how spiritual you are if you look around you and you're surrounded by people that love you. And I don't think that that's self-centered. I think that's just a good serenity check. You know, are there people around me that love me? Is my life filled with chaos? Is there constant conflict? Or is it pretty smooth? My mother died. I'm an orphan now. And I miss them. And I stand up here, and they did a lot of this. They traveled the country doing a lot of this just like I'm doing. Spreading the word, carrying the word. Now let me ask you a question. What if I would have said no to that man in my kitchen that day? What if I'd have not gone to the hospital? What would have happened? What if I would have made the choice because I felt uncomfortable that I'm not going to go to the hospital with him, that I don't have to do that, that we don't do that? What if I believed the lie that we're not a taxi service, we're not a lending institution, we're not an employment agency? Because that's bullshit. We are all those things. All those things. I will do whatever I can for you. And I don't have to set up boundaries. You know, I've always had boundaries. It's time to rid myself of those boundaries and deal with you, not send you away because you're inconvenient and you're infringing upon my boundaries, but to learn how to deal with you and express myself and my desires, my needs, my wants, not by sending you away. I cannot recover without you. You are an integral part of my recovery. If I want to do an inventory, another inventory, I should help you do one. It'll keep me in there all the time. If I want to read the book some more, read it with you. I have guys that come to me 6, 7, 8, 9 years sober, and they say they want to go through the steps again. I go, no! I'm not going to go through the steps. It was painful enough the first time. You know? How many people are you sponsoring? If you're not sponsoring people, you're not doing AA. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. The heart and soul of Alcoholics Anonymous is one alcoholic talking with another. That's all there is. There isn't anything else. People make the mistake of thinking the meetings are AA. The meetings aren't AA. The meetings are where we get together. But it's not AA. Is it an aspect of it? Well, of course it is. But it's not the heart and soul of it. It's not why I'm here. I shouldn't fool myself into thinking because I'm going to a lot of meetings, I'm doing a lot of AA. That's not true. I see people do that all the time. I see people that go to lots of meetings drink. I see people that go to lots of meetings and I do not want what they have. If I don't interact with you, my life will stay narrow the same way it was when I was drinking. What if I'd have said no to that guy in my kitchen that day? Would I have been ready to take care of my mother and father? I don't know that I can answer that. My sense is no. It would have set up a pattern. I'd have been able to say no the next time. It had been easier not to show up at your house when you're dying because it's painful for me to watch you die. I don't want to see that. When you call me up in the middle of the night and you need somebody to talk to, it'll be easier for me to say, no, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Call me in the morning. I'll meet you for coffee. I had a guy call me up one night and he wanted to come over. He was in crisis. He called me up and I said, well, get over here, you know. And he came to my front door. Karen was there and we had another couple in the house. And as a grown man, 40-year-old man, came across the living room at me and curled up in my lap like a little baby and put his head in my shoulder and cried like a baby. A grown man. That will get your attention. If you have any kind of prejudice at all, I can guarantee you something. If you have any prejudice at all, you can bet it'll come across the room and ask you for help. You can just wait for it. Now, if you want to keep your prejudice, keep it across the room. If you want to hang on to that prejudice, keep it across the room. I used to stand up at these podiums and I'd say, if you were on medication, you weren't sober. You know why I said that? Because I heard some of you say that, and I wanted to be a right-wing, death squad, badass AA dude. And it seemed like a real good opinion to have, you know. There's a certain amount of truth to it, and you could really hang on to that, you know. Then this guy walked across the room and he asked me for help and he says, I got to tell you, I'm bipolar and I'm on medication. I went, oh, shit. Because I'm told I don't ever, ever get to say no. Ever. For any reason. I don't have to have the same experience as you to help you either. I don't get to turn you away because you're a drug addict or whatever it is. I'll work the steps with anybody. I don't care. If it's not meant to be, we'll find out. So I start working the steps with this guy, and I had the experience of peeling him off the ceiling and lifting him up off the floor. Now when I see him coming, I say, have you taken your medication? Because you're sick, man. And this was the guy that came across the room curled up in my lap. So I had an opinion. Then I had an experience. It changed my opinion. That's how it works. Don't ever say no. You have no idea what's good for you. When have you ever known what was good for you? I have no idea how these decisions are going to affect my life. I have no idea. I am not sharp enough to be able to pick up on this stuff. I want to close with something that means a lot to me. I have a couple hours more material, but Terry gets a little pissy if I... like to piss off Terry. This was a poem that was written by a man by the name of Sam Shoemaker. He was the minister of Calvary Chapel in New York. It's where Ebbe Thatcher came from when he went to go get Bill Wilson. It's where the Oxford group met. And Wilson, when he went back looking for Ebbe to find out what the hell was wrong with that religious fanatic, he went to Calvary Chapel looking for him. And in the process of Bill getting sober, he met Sam Shoemaker and they became very close. As a matter of fact, Wilson went to Sam and asked him to write the book. And Sam, in his wisdom, said, no, Bill, this is your gig. I'll help. But this is for you to do. This is clearly your mission from God. Shoemaker wrote this poem. It's not about Alcoholics Anonymous, but you tell me if this isn't your AA. And if it's not, you might want to go look for this, because it exists. There's two kinds of people in AA. There's those who work the steps and those who don't. And those who don't work the steps think that there's a click. And they're right. It's those who work the steps. That's the click. Don't believe the lie that you have nothing to offer. Don't believe that lie. It'll keep you small. Step up to the plate. There's people out there that need you. They don't need me. They need you. There's someone out there that's waiting for you to hear the words come from your mouth, to ride in your car, to feel the love come from you. There's damaged, injured, hurt people out there. Where you and I are is the single most significant social movement of the 20th century. David Hawkins has written a book, and he talks about that probably 50% of the population of North America has been touched by AA. 50%. That is 300 million people. Now stop and think about it. AA, Al-Anon, NA, Narcanon, CA, Co-Anon, Overeaters Anonymous. There's 250 to 300 12-step groups that have spun off of Alcoholics Anonymous. We help them all. We give them the steps openly, freely. We'll help them. I go talk at some of these places. For every alcoholic like you and I, how many people do we affect in our drinking? How many people do we affect in our sobriety? How many people in our families look at it and they go, God damn, Bill got sober. Shit, there is a God. You know? I mean, seriously, people are affected by our recovery as much as they were by our drinking. 300 million people. There is nothing else that even compares to that. And that's just in North America. That's where you and I are. This has absolutely nothing to do with us. It isn't about me. I am finally, thank God, relieved of the bondage of self. I need no longer search for myself. Freedom, my salvation comes in my involvement with you, not in my involvement with me. And in that involvement with you, I will address all my character defects, my intolerance, my prejudice, all those things. I will become a larger person because of my lack of involvement with myself and my degree of involvement with you. If you ever catch yourself alone in a room thinking about your problems, get the hell out of the room. So Shoemaker wrote this poem. It's called I Stand by the Door. I stand by the door. I neither go too far in nor stay too far out. The door is the most important door in the world. It is the door through which men walk when they find God. There is no use my going way inside and staying there when so many are still outside and they, as much as I, crave to know where the door is. And all that so many ever find is only the wall where the door ought to be. They creep along the wall like blind men with outstretched groping hands, feeling for a door, knowing there must be a door, yet they never find it. So I stand by the door. The most tremendous thing in the world is for men to find that door, the door to God. The most important thing that any man or woman can do is to take hold of one of those blind, groping hands and put it on the latch that only clicks and opens to the man's own touch. Men die outside the door as starving beggars die on cold nights and cruel cities in the dead of winter, die for want of what is within their grasp. They live on the other side of it, live because they've not found it. Nothing else matters compared to helping them find it and open it and walk in and find him. So I stand by the door. I admire the people that go way in, but I wish they would not forget how it was before they got in. Then they would be able to help the people who have not yet even found the door. Or the people who want to run away again from God. You can go in too deeply and stay in too long and forget the people outside the door. As for me, I shall take my old accustomed place, near enough to God to hear him and know he is there, but not so far from men as to not hear them and remember that they are there too. Where? Outside the door. Thousands of them. Millions of them. But more important for me, one of them, two of them, 10 of them, whose hands I am intended to put on the latch, so I shall stand by the door and wait for those who seek it. I had rather be a doorkeeper. So I stand by the door. Thank you and God bless.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the Month Club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.